Back together for a brand new week with you, Monday, April 11th, 2022 on Connecticut Today. I talked about the growing influence of transgender issues now on the U.S. political landscape, and in my opinion, it's just too much. Time to back off. Landmark Legal Foundation attorney Mike O'Neill gave us his thoughts on President Biden's new gun control proposals. University of New Haven professor Dr. Olena Lenin, a native of eastern Ukraine, talked about the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine and what could be next. Every so often there is a political issue out there that I read about, I look at from afar, and I say to myself, are they going to take the bait again? Are they going to take the bait again? Do they not understand how this plays outside of New York, D.C., L.A., and Greater Chicago? And by they, I mean generally people who vote Democratic or the Democratic Party in general. And this time I'm talking about, as I've been reading about this more and more and more, this whole thing that you can't get away from it. Transgenderism. Transgender. And we see stories about this. I guess the most, well, two stories have been dominating. This guy, Leah Thomas, who competed in women's NCAA championship swimming events where he won one or two. And when the guy was competing as a guy, he was ranked like 450th in the country. And yet you have people saying, well, it's only right to let him slash her slash whatever he is compete because, you know, being a man or a woman, it's not just what your biological status is. Well, it is. I'm sorry. It is. Now, how somebody wants to live their lives, that's their business. I get that. I understand that. I understand that it's a serious situation when you have a woman, a biological woman, who for some reason, is it biochemical, is it psychiatric, whatever, everything is between our ears, feels that she is actually a man. Or in the reverse, a biological male who feels that he is actually a female. All right, I understand that. And that's probably been going on for, you know, whatever. I mean, years ago, it was years ago, right? You use the term, whether it's proper or not right now. But years ago, people heard the term transvestite. And you said, well, okay, whatever, you know. And it turns out that some pretty famous people in society, Hollywood types, law enforcement types, and you were like, well, geez, that's surprising. But, you know, whatever. Listen, to each his own. Okay. Now, it fired up a certain base on one side or the other. That's fine. But now, this whole thing with transgenderism is feeding into this political frenzy that is going to resonate in November. And I wonder if the Democratic Party as a whole, well, I'm sure some people in the party, the centrists, see it. And they're probably going, oh, please stop with this. We're going to get killed. And it's going to alter elections. Why? I'll tell you why coming up. First, traffic and weather together, 236 on WICC. So there's a battle going on right now, and I don't know if you've realized it or not, but maybe you have. But if you haven't, all you've got to do is sit back and watch what's happening here. And this goes back past, and we'll talk to what, you know, to why Governor Ron DeSantis did what he did recently in Florida with what they call the Don't Say Gay Bill. We'll talk about that. But this started with that special election that was held, what, a few months back when Glenn Youngkin, a relatively obscure private equity investment guy, was set up to run against for governor. In Virginia, against longtime Democrat Terry McAuliffe. He is a real power player in D.C. He was governor previously, and they thought this would be a coronation because the previous governor there was term limited. Isn't that nice? Term limits, huh? But Governor Ralph Northam couldn't run for more than two consecutive terms. Anyway, So Glenn Youngkin puts his foot, his ankle, his lower leg, his knee, and what other body part he could fit in there into his mouth. And a question that could have easily been handled a different way. He said something to the effect of, and I'm kind of paraphrasing when he was asked the question of, do parents have any say in what's taught to their kids in school? And McAuliffe butchered the answer, and that was an opening for Glenn Youngkin. And Youngkin and his campaign easily rode that to a narrow but expected win. And they did that primarily on the strength of suburban white moms. Okay, so fast forward now. And the Republicans see that and they go, Look at how many votes unexpectedly shifted toward Glenn Youngkin. And how many of those votes came from white suburban moms who shunned Donald Trump, but they came back to a moderate Republican because that Republican had said that those moms and dads have a right as to how their kids are taught. So then you have the passage of this Don't Say Gay bill, or this so-called Don't Say Gay bill in Florida, where the bill essentially says, listen, no discussion of gender issues until they're in the fourth grade, right? Kindergarten, first, second, third grade, it's not to be talked about or discussed or promoted in the classroom, right? And most clear-thinking people, most say, all right, third grade, yeah, fourth grade sounds right. Fourth grade now we're talking about. Fourth grade. So the bill says, listen, for kindergarten, first, second, and third grade in the Florida public school system, no discussion of gender issues. No discussion there's only one mom at home, there's only one dad at home, there's two dads, there's two moms, there's two moms and a dad, three dads and a mom, you know, whatever. Let's let kids be kids, okay? But now this has infuriated Democrats in the big cities because for some reason they think this is a winning issue. It's not. It's a winning issue, though, with suburban parents who are saying, wait a minute, what are you doing here? We will discuss that with our kids, with our sons, with our daughters at the appropriate time. And the left is saying, well, what if that child has two dads at home or two moms? You don't think that they talk about that with their kid? You don't think that clear-thinking moms and dads, or dads and dads, or moms and moms, whatever the family dynamic is, you don't think that they've already thought about that? Do you morons in some of the public school systems think that that you've got to be the purveyor of this? So here's a story over the weekend that just, I read this and I said, oh my God, they're going to get hammered on this in the election season. If I can indulge you, please. This is from the New York Post, okay? But it's well footnoted. It has all links. And this is what I mean. The left, now the right does it too. Republicans do it too, but they don't do it like the left. The left overplays their hands on guns. They're doing it today. President Biden speaking right now. They overplay their hands on guns all the time. They overplay their hands on immigration all the time. They overplay their hands on taxes all the stinking time. And now they're about to do it. They're about to do this on gender issues, because this has become the new battlefield. Well, Paul, it should be, because did you see what Ron DeSantis did? Yeah, you know what Ron DeSantis did? He put out a big chunk of red meat, oozing red meat for you, and you took it right there. You chomped on it like the shark in Jaws. Wait till you hear this. Swallow any food you have in your mouth, because you're gonna choke when I read this stuff to you. We'll get to that straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. So this from the New York Post over the weekend, but it showed up in a bunch of other area outlets as well. And again, we're talking about the big push here, because gender identity issues, that's become the new rallying point for the left. I don't know whether you saw that video that was out there a few days ago, the head of Disney, one of the high-ranking women at Disney, and it was on Twitter. She didn't hide this video. This is not like a Project Veritas subversive video here. She was saying, well, in a few years, every Disney character is going to be minority or gender this or gender that. I'm sorry, she said 50%. 50% are going to be minorities and gender this or gender questioning that or whatever. And I'm like, really? And listen, I understand that characters in any play, any movie, any script should be reflective of society. I got that. Not everybody is tall, white, blonde hair, blue eyed, and lives in middle America. I get that. I don't want to hear you calling up and saying, well, you just don't understand the issue. No, I understand it. I get it. But stop telling people or parents they have to agree with this or that. Planned sex education lessons for first graders in New Jersey will include discussions of gender identity. Number one, why in the hell are we giving first graders, we're not talking fifth, fourth, third, first graders. You're 6 years old in first grade. You're still trying to figure out what way is up. You're 6 years old. You're six. Now, I know there are allegations from the right saying, well, they're trying to indoctrinate kids. And I say, that's a strong word. But then I read a story like this and say, well, six years old. Six. A 30-minute lesson called Pink, Blue, and Purple, okay, aims to teach the six-year-olds to define gender, gender identity, and gender role stereotypes. 6 years old, folks, six. Now, you have people saying, no, we're not, are you kidding? How dare you say that we're indoctrinating kids to be gender fluid? Well, 6 years old. Listen, this is different if you're talking to somebody who's 16 or 17 or 15 or even 10 or 12. Six. It also includes instructions for teachers to tell students that their gender identity is up to them, according to materials reportedly given to parents at a February 22nd meeting of the Westfield Board of Education, and they were posted online as well. The lesson plan says in parts, quote, you might feel like you're a boy even if you have body parts that some people might say are girl parts. Okay. Now, again, folks, this is not aimed at pubescent or prepubescent boys or girls, 6 years old. Six. This is crazy. We're losing our minds here. And this is not to denigrate anybody who has doubts about their sexual identity. But again, time and a place. And maybe the place should be with the parents. Maybe. I don't know. I don't pretend to judge people on how they raise their kids. The lesson plan goes on, quote, you might feel like a girl even if you have body parts that some people might say are boy parts. And you might not feel like you're a boy or a girl, but you're a little bit of both. No matter how you feel, you're perfectly normal. Okay, I see what you're trying to say. But come on. If you tell this to somebody in first grade, I mean, let's say the kid, the guy, the girl in first grade, let's say they have a little bit of a rough home life. You never know what goes on to these homes. And now you're going to sprinkle this in there at 6 years old. And this is my point, folks. People see issues like this and they vote on it because somebody will see, again, a suburban white mom. Let's get back to my original point here. A suburban white mom is going to see this and say, are you kidding? I'm not voting for this. And unfortunately, whether it's fair or not, this reflects on the party that supports that. A lesson plan for second graders titled Understanding Our Bodies includes an illustrated discussion of human genitals, so kids as young as 7 can use medically accurate names for their private parts. It tells the teachers, quote, tell students there are some body parts that mostly just girls have. Mostly just girls have, and some parts that mostly just boys have. What do you mean mostly? What? A note to teachers also says, quote, being a boy or a girl does not have to mean you have those parts. But for most people, it's how those bodies are. Oh, my God in heaven. Oh, again, understand me here. I understand where once a kid gets older, a guy or a girl, a guy or a gal, they enter pre-puberty, they're saying, hey, I don't know, I don't feel right, I'm a boy attracted to boy, girl attracted to girls. You know, I get that. But first and second grade, you're introducing thoughts into a child at an age where they're still trying to figure out the freaking world. And it is just, I guess there are some parents here that are just crazy about this. And I don't blame them. And again, you turn on any newscast anywhere, and what do you hear? Transgender this, transgender that, transgender this, transgender that. And I'm telling you, it is a new sacrament out there. And the minute you say, hey, should we pump the brakes a little bit on this, you're immediately branded a bigot. It is maddening. One of our go-to legal eagles, Mike O'Neill, is joining us from the Landmark Legal Foundation, going to talk about this whole scenario of ghost guns. I mean, a lot of people that listen to this show know what they are, that follow the issue, but some people may not. And Mike O'Neill joins us this afternoon. Mike, good to have you on, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. How are you?
Not too bad. What do you make of what the president is trying to do here with ghost guns? And I was reading some stuff, actually, Mike, earlier today after this this announcement, and there is, I know, some constitutional debate, at least on a federal level, what a government can do about guns, regulating the manufacturer and maybe people who do this as a hobby. What are your thoughts on this?
Right. Well, first of all, we're dealing with a specifically enumerated right here, one that is laid out in plain language and plain text of the Second Amendment, and it's your right to bear arms. And again, we're going from the Heller decision, which was that decision that came out of Washington, D.C. a few years ago from the Supreme Court, which said that you have a right to bear arms for self-defense. And then we're mixing in here a long history of gun, not manufacturing is the wrong term, but gun building that our country has hundreds of years of our history. There have been a strong cultural presence of gun, I don't want to say manufacturing, because you're not actually taking the pieces and boiling them down and creating them, but you are assembling gun assembly in our culture, in our history, and we have hundreds of years of that. So we're dealing with a specifically enumerated right. We're dealing with a long hundreds of years of history, and we're looking at what is the federal government doing, namely the Democrats, Joe Biden, the left. They are seeking to come in here and impose the full power of the Department of Justice through a regulation, another one of these burdensome regulations upon our constitutional right. And in this case, what this new rule that has been finalized today that was released with a lot of pageantry out here and a big announcement from Joe Biden from the White House. I think he held a press conference on it just wrapped up basically an hour ago, saying that the government now is going to the Department of Justice is going to require anybody who assembles these guns, who has these, to regulate them to qualify as firearms. They're going to qualify these gun kits as firearms under the Gun Control Act and require manufacturers to be licensed and to include serial numbers on these kits. And again, this is a really big stretch of the regulations. This is a big stretch of the Gun Control Act. It is another administrative agency standing in the shoes of Congress and making a law that's going to apply to a large sector of our country, one that specifically involves the Second Amendment, one that we know is strictly regulated, is that the government, in order to regulate it, the government has to clear a very high burden. So we've got a lot of kind of moving parts here with this. My go away here is, again, is you're seeing the left trying to impose through the regulatory process that which they cannot impose through the statutory process. In other words, they want to regulate it rather than go through Congress and pass any kind of law.
Interesting. Okay, Mike, so hang on. I want to get into a couple things here. Mike O'Neill from the Landmark Legal Foundation saying this is governmental overreach, but the president came out, and I guess he likened it today, and it was a good PR kind of push on this. He likened it to buying something from IKEA. Or somebody said there, you know the sofa, the dresser. Well, it's not really a sofa or a dresser until you put it together. Should that apply with guns? More on this with Mike O'Neill, First Traffic and Weather Together, right here on WICC. Mike O'Neill from the Landmark Legal Foundation, one of our legal eagles, back with us for another segment here regarding what the president announced today or proposed new regulations for so-called ghost guns are actually, you know, kit guns where you order the parts or you actually can manufacture the parts now with these high-tension polymers and other substances using these 3D printers, which are pretty amazing things. And, Mike, the president said today he used the props there, the gun parts, saying, well, it may not be a gun now, but when I assembled it, there was a gun violence survivor who likened it to buying a sofa at IKEA. Yeah, you have to put it together, but at the end, you do have a sofa. So is it, Mike, let me get into the weeds a little with this, with you on this. Is this the fact that they would want to do this at all, or the way they're going about it? Is that what makes you uncomfortable? Because you mentioned before the break, it's an extension of a policy and does not go through Congress. Talk about that.
Right. Well, there's a couple of, there's the process and then there's the policy. When you want to talk about the policy, we can look at a few different levels here. You can look at whether federal registration laws, federal gun registration laws are effective in curbing crime. Now, what exactly is the goal here? The goal is to curb crime. Is there any information out there? Are there studies that have been conducted that show that federal registration laws curb crime? And I think there's a debate about that, a very strong case to be made that none of these federal laws on the Department of Justice passing these new regulations, implementing these new regulations, actually have an effect on curbing gun violence. So there's that issue. Then there's the second issue. That we always talk about when we're dealing with the gun issue in general is, do criminals, people who commit crimes with firearms, ever comply with any of these regulations, any of these registration laws or any of these regulation laws? I mean, I really think that the folks who are adhering to these laws and following any of these regulations or going through all of this are law-abiding citizens. And those are the people who do not commit crimes with guns. So you've got the policy issues, which, again, whether a federal registration policy is actually effective in curbing gun violence. Again, any registration law, you have to look into the fact that whether it actually keeps guns out of the hands of criminals. And then again, so there's the policy point. That's big one. And then there's, again, the procedural point. That's big issue two here. Big issue two is, who's making this decision? And I've said this to you on your show many times. Again, this is in the context of the environmental regulations we're talking about here and the Second Amendment issues we're talking about here in this case. It's who's deciding. Now, in this case, you have Department of Justice bureaucrats unaccountable to the people imposing a burdensome regulation upon gun owners in this country involving a strong Second Amendment constitutional right. Do we want to have bureaucrats in this country making up these regulations that we are all obligated to follow, or do we want to have accountable members of Congress who are specifically empowered by the Constitution to make these decisions? Incidentally, I did a little research on this. There is a law that has been proposed in Congress, H.R. 1454, called the Ghost Guns Are Guns Act. Mm-hmm. So there is a movement in Congress to make these ghost guns, classify them as firearms under the Gun Control Act. So Democrats and liberals know how to do it. They just rather not.
The other thing, Mike, that's interesting in looking at this proposal, saying, well, these kits then have to be stamped, the parts have to be regulated and have numbers on them. Well, what's, Mike O'Neill, to stop somebody from ordering a kit or ordering kits and being nefarious and putting these guns together and selling them, and in the process just eliminating the part. I mean, you know, like stolen electronics. You rub off the serial number, and then it gets caught up in court, and a judge says, well, counsel, this is not a definable issue here. We all think it is, but I can't prove it, so case dismissed. What's to stop that?
I don't know. Just being very frank, and I don't have a background in criminal defense or criminal law, but as I understand it, you can. I don't know if police have ways around when you scrape off those serial numbers when you try to make the gun cold, as we'd say, or not traceable. I don't know. And I don't know how criminals. And again, criminals. The Supreme Court defined, you know, water in the context of political expenditures. A famous Supreme Court justice said, money like water will always find its way out. Yeah. And I always think criminals will always find a way around any regulation anybody wants to put forth regarding this. If you're bound and determined to commit some sort of crime using a firearm, you're going to find a firearm no matter how onerous the regulations are on legitimate gun owners and respectable law-abiding gun owners in this country.
Mike O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation. Check him out. Check out Mike's writings and Landmark Legal online, landmarklegal.org. Mike, thank you. We appreciate it. We'll chat down the road. Thank you.
Always, Paul. You have a great day.
You too, man. Mike O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation, landmarklegal.org. They deal with a lot of constitutional issues, property issues, things like that. So interesting stuff. Check it out. So listen. This has no shot to pass in the Senate. It'll pass in the House. This has no shot to pass in the Senate because they'll never get the 60 votes for cloture. And away we go. And again, it's a midterm election year. And the reason you introduce a bill like this, if you're the Democrats, you say very simply, and this happens on the state level here in Connecticut, even in a local level, you know, Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, you say, well, geez, how could you vote for this person who doesn't support this? This is common sense, right? A kit gun is a gun. But there's probably some legal argument to say it isn't. And police do say that more of these ghost guns or kit guns are showing up in crimes. And again, though, what's the key word of that sentence? Crimes. You know? Done by, ding, 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 criminals. The ongoing tragedy in Ukraine, the devastation, of course, now long stirring the talk of war crimes. We've been talking about that for a couple of weeks. When will it end? What is Mr. Putin's next move? Joining us, a return visit from Dr. Olena Lennon. She's an adjunct professor in political science and international affairs at the University of New Haven, a Fulbright scholar and also an Eastern Ukraine native as well. Dr. Lennon, Paul again here on WICC. Thank you for returning. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So what are you hearing? It's sad to hear, I guess, that the buzz now, Dr. Lennon, is that Russia will now concentrate its efforts, if these reports are to be believed, on eastern Ukraine. What are you hearing, and what are your thoughts on that?
That is absolutely correct. Russia has regrouped, resupplied after the humiliating retreat from around Kyiv, and are now moving thousands of more troops and columns of armored and supply vehicles into offensive positions around Donbas region in eastern Ukraine, where they're currently occupying two of the so-called republics. So they actually have an easier way of reinforcing their troops there. And one other adjustment that they have made, as it appears from satellite images and military intelligence, is that they're actually bringing a lot more supplies. And one of the mistakes they made in the initial offensive was that they ran out of supplies too early. They couldn't reinforce their troops. So now they have learned from their mistakes. They're readjusting and seem to be poised for a new major offensive in eastern Ukraine.
Does this at all, Dr. Lennon, reinforce the possibility of the buzz we've been hearing is that, well, he can't control the whole country. He can inflict all this horrible damage. And if he can control the Donbas and maybe one other region, he'll then consider that a victory.
That is one of the scenarios, and definitely one of the hypotheses is that Putin had scaled back his original war aims from these maximalist objectives to force capitulation on the Zelensky regime after having been unable to achieve anything or force Ukraine to capitulate. They seem to be refocusing on at least some measurable or some achievable objective that they could present back home as a victory. But, you know, they've always had an interest in expanding their territories in eastern Ukraine. So it's not necessarily a new front. You know, eastern Ukraine and southern Ukraine have also been included in their original war aims, but they seem to be concentrating on that front a little bit more now. Because, again, one of the mistakes that they made initially was that they underestimated Ukrainian forces, so they spread themselves too thin by attacking from all three fronts, from the north, south, and the east. So now they're regrouping and actually concentrating in the east, where we're expecting to see some major tank battles in the next few days.
Dr. Olena Lennon is the guest. Dr. Lennon, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Want to expound on a few things here with Dr. Olena Lennon. She's an adjunct professor of political science and international affairs at the University of New Haven, Fulbright scholar, and a native of eastern Ukraine. More with Dr. Lennon straight ahead. But first, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And our weekly check-in with an authority around the area. We've been tapping the brains of several area folks with knowledge of international affairs, Russia, Ukraine, as to what's going on in and around the region. Today we have a return visit from Dr. Olena Lennon. She is an adjunct professor in political science and international affairs at the University of New Haven. She's also a Fulbright scholar and a native of eastern Ukraine. Dr. Lennon, you said something before the break that I hear all over the place and from other experts like yourselves, is that Vladimir Putin likely underestimated the pushback or what he was going to get from the Ukraine forces. You know, a lot of people hear that, Dr. Lennon, and they say, well, geez, you know, how could he have done that? Well, it's not the KGB anymore, it's the FSB. Was their intelligence not good enough? Were they deceived? How was Mr. Putin so wrong, at least up to now, about this?
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. One is intelligence failures. You know, what we have learned in just the last couple of weeks, too, from our own intelligence is that it seems as though Putin has been getting curated information, filtered intelligence from his own inner circles who are, you know, fearful of him and who need to deliver results because he's expecting victory. So they haven't been honest with him about all the losses that the Russian army has suffered. But the other aspect of it is to that, you know, Putin has been underestimating Ukraine for a very long time, and part of it is due to his own biases and hubris that he has cultivated and a very curated information space in which the entire Russian society really operates. It's a very different information environment, heavily censored, that, you know, a dissent is punished. And so it's very difficult to relay any accurate information that may contradict the official Russian point of view. So I think the combination of those information deficiencies and intelligence deficiencies has led to this general perception that Russia is a superior military power and it should have no problem squashing Ukrainian defensive forces. So that's one aspect is definitely intelligence. But the other thing, mm-hmm. too, I think that Russia was encouraged by some of the successes in limited military campaigns in Syria and Nagorno-Karabakh, the war between Azerbaijan and Armenia, where they had some military successes there, but those were, you know, quite limited military campaigns. But I think they gave the Russian army that sort of sense of optimism and inflated superiority over what they thought they could also achieve over Ukrainian forces.
Interesting. What do you make of this this new general now that has been anointed by Putin to carry on the battle? He's 60, General Alexander Dvornikov. What do we know about him?
Right. So one of the things that Western media in particular emphasizes is his experience in Syria, that he was, you know, critical in designing, you know, in strategic and tactical design of Russia's engagement in Syria, particularly with the bombardment of densely populated urban areas to increase pressure on, you know, anti-government protesters and rebels and basically force their surrender. So there's an expectation that he will use similar tactics in Ukraine because the Russians think that they were successful in Syria. From their point of view, that went well. So I think they're trying to replicate this. So I think that the emphasis on his Syrian experience is overstated, because most senior level commanders in Russia have rotated through Syria. So that's actually one of the points of confidence in the Russian military, is that a lot of their commanders are battlefield tested and they have that battlefield experience. So I wouldn't overemphasize his Syria experience, because that's most commanders in Russia by now. But the fact that he is expected to be more brutal and more aggressive in sort of the conduct of urban warfare, I think is warranted.
Finally, Dr. Lennon, the notion of either Russian forces or mercenaries taking out, killing, assassinating Volodymyr Zelensky, you think they're still trying to do that? Or is this now a case where Mr. Zelensky has gained so much worldwide notoriety that doing that now would actually be worse for Russia? Or does Putin not care?
I don't know, of course, is the answer. I think they're definitely trying to humiliate him. I think they want Ukraine to be humiliated and surrender. By I don't know if they could achieve that by assassinating Zelensky, because that would make Russia a pariah state for generations. I don't think that they need that legacy, because it would make them more isolated. And eventually they want to be reintegrated into the international community. They're trying to present, they're going to present this as Ukraine's fault, for starting the war. So I think their ultimate objective is to humiliate Zelensky and to make him a bad example for other leaders to follow. And assassination would make Zelensky a hero, a martyr, right? It would actually elevate Zelensky's image in the eyes of the international community. So I think it would actually do a disservice to what Russia is trying to achieve. They want him to surrender.
Yeah, that's probably would be a better visual for them. Exactly. Dr. Olena Zelensky, professor, adjunct professor of political science and international affairs at the University of New Haven. Dr. Zelensky, thank you. Good to hear from you again, and we'll chat down the road. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Dr. Olena Zelensky, adjunct professor, political science and international affairs at the University of New Haven, also a Fulbright scholar and a native of Eastern Ukraine.